is the Grahamian Report. The unusual, weird news, anomalies, exopolitics. It's beyond the fringe, where conspiracy theory can become conspiracy fact. This is the Grahamian Report with your host, Mike Evans.
From hundreds of miles beneath terra firma in the depths of the hollow earth, live from the Grahamian Bunker. Well, bunker number two. This is what we call Studio B down here at Grahamian International Headquarters, as I am abroad, elsewhere, traveling cosmogirally through space-time. That's right, I am your doctor here in the heart of the Hollow Earth, Micah Hanks, and it is the Grahamian Report. Happy Halloween, everybody. For those of you who celebrate, hopefully you do, because in hour two, we're going to be breaking down some of the nuances of, I think, what are the high points, the finer areas of modern horror cinema. And truly some eerie stuff. We're also going to get to some news and update from one of our buddies who has been ousted in the UFO community. Yeah. That, and of course, some pseudo-archaeological ancient astronaut theories. Some of which I think are very interesting. And then I think that also there's the archaeological side that we have to look at scientifically. Joining me in studio, as always, the producer, the man with the kind eyes, the Grahamian Reverend himself, Mr. Matthew Oakley. Good day, sir.
Good day to you. It's good to be here in the old number two.
The old number two. Yeah, when studio number one floods at certain times of the year, I think it has to do with lunar cycles, Matt. Then we have to come down here, down the hallway to Studio B.
It's not that bad of a trek, though. I mean, we're pretty close.
Yeah, yeah, it's okay. Actually, the truth is that with our travel schedules right now, I can't name the location, but yes, we are traveling. We are not in the bunker at all. But we have to kind of maintain that illusion. It was funny because Jason Pentrell said to me the other day, Matt, that he said, I remember back in the old days when I would listen to the Grahamian Report and hear the discussion about the bunker, I would imagine this hollow cavern or maybe a fallout shelter or something. He said they must have rented some really rad kind of a place under a building in downtown Asheville. People write in with these vivid descriptions of how they envision the bunker and how it appears on the interior. By the way, as dark as it is, even though we're not in a cave right now, why are you wearing sunglasses?
I figured I'd go with the Artie Lang vibe, if you're familiar. You know, Howard Stern's co-host.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, yeah, one of them.
So you got that vibe,
yeah,
okay.
Yeah, yeah. It just sans the heroin and all that.
Well, check out some of the decor that I've done here in this studio where we are right now. Notice the little votive candles.
I love it.
Candles all over the place. In fact, check out the hanging clock.
Yeah, there is so much ambiance going around right now. I think we need to give a fair description of where we're sitting right now so we can get some kind of artist rendering of this, and we'll hang it up in some grand frame.
We should. Okay, yeah. So I'll begin by describing that there are votive candles all over the place, clocks hanging on the walls. My copy of Jacques Bergier's Extraterrestrial Visitation from Prehistoric Times to the Present.
I've got Earth in Upheaval over here by Emmanuel Velikovsky.
I laid out old paperback books dealing with unexplained subjects and things. I strewed those about so as to kind of build on that vibe that I'm hoping to achieve down here. Got my copy of Ancient Mysteries of the Americas back over there, and then of course my archaeology textbook, which is just a first-year archaeology textbook. Really, it's that simple. But, I mean, I read, I've got textbooks on every subject. I do. I keep physics textbooks, chemistry textbooks, and the reason being, of course, that I'm interested in science. I'm one of those people who has a remarkable mixture in my library of good, what some would call good academic source literature, and then good pseudoscience source literature. And with time, you know, I get sent a lot of books by publishers and things like that, and I've had to go and, you know, hop down to Mr. K's and trade some of those in for, again, more scientific kind of books, because that's what my mind gravitates toward more these days. You know, I was on the KT Unearthly show, shooting from the lip last night, and Kevin, the normal host, wasn't on, although he chimed in a little later in the program, called in, but Tiffany, our very own Tiffany Mack, was hosting all by herself, and so I was her guest, and it was really interesting as we were going down alleged mysterious deaths of ufologists over the years. That was our subject. She picked this out because, you know, she kind of wanted to talk about Max Spears and then look at the other instances where there have been alleged deaths of ufologists that have taken place. And I have to say, it was quite interesting, some of the discussion that we got into. For instance, okay, the Thomas Mantell incident has long been kind of held as a possible death as it relates to a UFO encounter. Thomas Mantell was a pilot. He went chasing after a UFO back in the, I guess that actually would have occurred in the late 1940s, 1948 probably. And he takes off to an unsafe altitude, and then, of course, his aircraft, as one would expect, and I don't think it was a pressurized chamber in that aircraft at that time. And he's seen dropping out of the sky, and he falls and crashes, and Mantell was killed in that instance. But what it involved, of course, was a guy who had flown to an unsafe altitude and probably passed out due to the thin air at that location. What he was probably chasing, as was the interpretation by Edward J. Ruppelt at the time, who was the head of Project Blue Book, was that he was actually following a balloon. But the reason he was following a balloon, and Tiffany asked this question, she said, okay, so you mean to tell me here's a U.S. Air Force pilot who didn't realize it was a balloon he was chasing? Well, it was a very large, high-altitude balloon that was a top-secret project at the time, and so probably due to his clearance, he was not aware of the kind of balloon, and of course, to him, it is perceived from below. It looked like a great big round object. He thought it was a saucer, and so he goes after the thing and tries to engage it, flies to an unsafe altitude, falls out of the sky, of course, lands. Well, he doesn't land. He crashes. Didn't end up very well for him. But the Mantell incident is interesting because a lot of authors over the years have continued to cite that as being evidence of UFOs and a possible hostile intent, when in fact, I think that that was just a case of misidentification by a pilot. Whether or not indeed that involved an unidentified flying object, I think the evidence pretty clearly says what it was. But again, when we think about the Valentich case, Frederick Valentich back in 1978, you know, the anniversary of that incident was just a few days ago.
Yeah.
Yeah, it was in October 1978. And what he described was much more obviously, to my way of thinking, some sort of an anomalous aerial phenomena. And although he wasn't chasing it or trying to engage it as Mantell had been doing, obviously, because he was a civilian pilot in a Cessna, he said that the object appeared to be orbiting him. That was the terminology, of course. And he had said that immediately before air traffic control in Melbourne lost contact with Valentich, he said that the thing was directly above him hovering, or at very least pacing his aircraft in such a way that it seemed like it was, you know, moving alongside his aircraft or directly above it, rather. So that's a much stranger UFO-related death. And again, we can only presume that he was killed. We don't know the fate of Frederick Valentich, but it seems pretty safe to say, in my mind, that he probably died. I think that that's what most people think. As far as UFO-related deaths, I mean, are there any that really stick out in your mind, apart from Max Spears, which we talked about last week?
Yeah, yeah, and there is one that I don't think there's any question that can be had. It isn't directly involving a UFO, but it is involving a ufologist, or a claimed one for at least a long time, the majority of his career, Bill Cooper.
Yeah.
You know, that his death was always just this crazy story to me, where kind of a Wild West, like going out guns a blazing, literally, saying they'll never take me alive, and getting in a gunfight with the U.S. Marshals who were there to arrest him for tax evasion and several other minor offenses.
Well, you know, and when you say minor offenses, I mean, that may not be a minor offense, but I mean, he wasn't guilty of, you know, killing anybody. I mean, he hadn't carried out a heist or a bank robbery or anything like that. I mean, yeah, tax evasion was all they really had on Cooper, although he was an interesting character. Funny that you bring that up, by the way, Matt, because Tiffany asked about Bill Cooper last night during our talk, too.
Yeah.
Yeah, and I find Cooper's interesting, he's interesting, I think, for a number of reasons, but the first one is, of course, yes, it was a strange, tragic, but strange set of circumstances that led to his death. And let's not forget that, as many will tell you, Bill Cooper was a person, he right around the time of his death, he had a drinking problem. He apparently also had really kind of gone more into that paleoconservative sort of
the militia, anti-government type stuff.
He was very much of that mind. Yeah, he was. And the shootout that you described led to the death of a law enforcement officer as well as Bill Cooper. They intended to go and arrest him. And yeah, like you said, he said, I'm not going out. You know, well, he did go out with guns blazing.
He was quoted by the Marshals Service saying that he would not be taken alive.
And so, he wasn't. He wasn't. So not only did he die, he was killed, but also there was one of the officers involved that was killed, too. So it was a tragic, frankly, I think a very senseless set of circumstances. But what was interesting about Cooper in relation to UFOs is that Cooper had initially been one of these MJ-12 people. I mean, he had been an individual who claimed that he had been shown documents that confirmed the existence of this secret UFO study group within government. And then Cooper, thereafter, it's odd how things went, because he went on the lecture circuit for a number of years. He kind of became a popular UFO speaker. And then after a certain amount of time, and again, I think not for want of interest, because he had pursued the UFO subject. He would take people out there to Area 51, well, as close as they could get. They would probably go to Peekaboo Peak, I guess. You know, I've been invited. I won't name him here, but he knows who he is. I've been invited by one of our listeners to go up there and camp, because that's about the closest you can get, and from distance with a really clear range, you know, or clear weather conditions, rather, you can see across the terrain, and you can actually see Area 51, the Groom Lake facility. So that was probably one of the locations he was taking people, and they were filming strange lights in the sky and things that were obviously aircraft tests that were going on out there. But Cooper, beyond a certain point, kind of lost faith in the UFO myth. He began to say, you know, I think my government lied to me. I don't think that there's as much evidence that suggests something unexplained or alien. He said, to me, it's quite evident these are all our own projects, our own technologies, and the misinformation campaign being brought to the table by government agencies like the U.S. Air Force and his former employers at the U.S. Navy. Yeah, he said that they were purposefully feeding bad information to the public.
Well, and I also think you have to take into account his air of credibility around that time where he stopped dealing with UFOs as much. He had been called out by a lot of people in places like UFO Magazine, mm-hmm, for, you know, kind of giving out what they saw as bunk work on the subject, because he started linking the Illuminati and the New World Order and what was that document he got into for so long and preached about, the Protocols of the Elders of Zion, whatever.
And, yeah.
You know, linked all this stuff together, which had, I mean, let's face it, a borderline racist attitude towards it.
Yeah, there was plenty of that. So, plenty of that present, which is, I think, the black mark on him.
Yeah.
I warn people, I find Cooper very interesting, and I don't find all of his interpretations of the grand dark conspiracy to be completely lacking any substance. But, I mean, you got to be really careful when it comes to Cooper, because even Alex Jones has said, you know, he and Alex Jones, you'd think that they would have been big buddies, and Jones had him on his show a few times, but Cooper would often get intoxicated when he would go on Alex Jones' radio show, and he would be using swear words, and Alex would have to intervene. You know, we're live on the air. You can't. Just, I mean, Mr. Cooper, you just can't use those terms. And he would pretty much just say, okay, you know, screw off, guy. You know, and he would use very colorful language when he wasn't supposed to, and Alex would have to, you know, really drop the call often. And I think on one occasion, Cooper had called in and had just been berating Jones. To his credit, Jones...
That's a switch, right?
Yeah, it is, because, you see, you know, Jones as being that modern equivalent to Bill Cooper. Bill Cooper, not just an author of books like Behold a Pale Horse, but he did a shortwave radio show for years from his home called Hour of the Time. Did you ever hear Hour of the Time, Matt?
I didn't.
You didn't?
I do have a copy of Behold a Pale Horse, but I've never heard the radio show.
I want you to hear, listen, this is what the intro to that show sounded like. If you've never heard it, this is worth hearing.
Okay.
And the rest of the intro sounds an awful lot like the sounds from hell that Art Bell featured on his show.
It was so weird what the guy did. Like, did you read Behold a Pale Horse?
No, I don't think I even own a copy of that. If I do, it's packed away somewhere. I own far more books than I probably should.
Well, there was the section in Behold a Pale Horse that where he kind of put forth the idea that JFK was assassinated because he was about to reveal that extraterrestrials were in the process of, you know, invading Earth. And he had said that, you know, William Greer, the driver there in Dallas.
Oh, yeah. Okay, yeah.
William Greer had used a gas pressure device developed by aliens from the Trilateral Commission to shoot the president from the driver's seat.
Okay.
So, you know, it's just... I honestly feel it's a little sad to see somebody who had some good ideas early on and was fairly well respected, and then this kind of just de-evolution of kind of sensibility.
No, yeah, I think it did get worse with time. And, you know, my favorite Bill Cooper story would have arguably been the one where Jacques Vallée went out to meet him. Vallée and his wife went out and they met Cooper. And they met him on, I almost want to say that at the time there was a dining establishment on the Queen Mary, which is actually where they went and had dinner. And, you know, Vallée listened very politely, but he kind of found Cooper to be pretty fringy with his ideas. And he said that after they met, apparently Cooper had continued to try and have, you know, dialogue with Vallée, and that Vallée wasn't exactly open to it because he perceived Cooper as being an extremely fringe person. If you want to read this account, the entire thing is discussed in the book, not Confrontations, that's the second one. I guess it's Revelations, which is the third in the what was republished by Patrick Wiege at Anomalous Books as the Alien Contact Trilogy, which... I think alien is a fair word, but maybe not extraterrestrial, because if you read Vallée's work, he's very careful not to say, I think UFOs represent aliens visiting from someplace else. He thinks that, I mean, that there's definitely something non-human.
But he's not saying it's aliens.
He really is not saying it's aliens. I mean, this is why I respect Vallée so much. Many people in the modern, you know, academic establishment consider him as pseudoscientific as anybody else, but I really think he is a scientist with a background in astrophysics and also with computer science. He is a person who was involved with the creation of early wide area networks that would become later on the World Wide Web. And Vallée was also somebody who definitely had a skeptical bent about things. And so that entire book is Vallée's interpretation of different people in the UFO community, some of them including Linda Moulton Howe, John Lear. We had Bill Cooper. And so, again, in the book, there's Bill Cooper's story, which is so great because after they have dinner and after this whole experience with Cooper at dinner takes place, he continues to try and have further dialogue with Vallée. And one night, Vallée says it culminates in Cooper calling his home and just screaming over the telephone with him, "We know who you are! We know who you work for!" I mean, who does that sound like?
Yeah, Alex Jones, especially when you do it in that voice.
Yes, exactly. Yeah. So Cooper, you know, again, Cooper and Jones didn't get along, but, you know, after his death, Alex Jones has never really spoken ill, but I think he's spoken very frankly about Cooper and said that, listen, you got to keep in mind, Cooper had some, again, this coming from Alex Jones, some dangerous beliefs about things. Frankly, at times, some wacky beliefs, and yes, he also was an alcoholic. And so...
But you have the correlation, too, of Alex Jones as well as Bill Cooper being so entrenched and against things like the Bilderberg Group and stuff,
deny the commonality. But yeah. I think that, again, Alex Jones kind of grew out of that modern, you know, kind of fringe right militia movement of the,
to an extent,
of the 1990s. Alex kind of came on the tail end of that. But really, early on, Alex's... his contributions, I think, were far more intelligent. I think he was far more, you know, Alex was a reporter. He always had the gravelly kind of a Ren and Stimpy cartoon sounding voice, but he was much more a reporter. He did infiltrate Bohemian Grove. He did bring back footage showing this strange cremation of care ceremony and the great big owl. I mean, Alex, you can't say that Alex Jones and some of his work isn't without merit. It is just that I think... as time has gone on, he has become more an entertainer rather than a credible reporter.
Yeah.
And he lost his credibility in the mainstream idea, or in the sense of things, I guess, after 9/11. It was after 9/11 that when he went on there and he said this was a false flag, inside job, and our government was behind it, his radio stations started dropping him, I mean, like flies.
And we don't know what it's like to have
that. Yes. There's the famous. But, you know, you hear some of the clips of Alex Jones now, and I mean, you really got to be careful. I mean, this guy... I don't think that Alex Jones is completely crazy, but then again, I mean, he does say things like this.
Pentagon's like, how do we get the jellyfish into total war? Dance around and prance.
We've had a lot of fun with Alex Jones sound bites over the years. I wonder if I've got any more. Let me just see here. We've got so much stuff. Oh, yes. Okay. So I've got my Alex Jones sound bank here. Here's a great one where he's calling into his own show while he was traveling. And, well, you know, the rest is history.
Alex Jones here reporting live as I board a Southwest Airlines flight from Denver to Austin from Omaha. I went up there to conduct some business and also to attend a wedding. I had some very interesting experiences up there analyzing what's happening to the country that fits into what I witnessed in areas of Europe about a month and a half ago. I'll be back tomorrow live hosting the entire 5 days of the week myself, and then the Sunday broadcast coming up. And we're going to be breaking down the Pope's visit to Philadelphia, D.C., and other areas.
I got to give you some context. What he's doing here is he's saying he's reporting live from an airport, and he's got his voice. He's you know, talking kind of in a hushed voice, and he's saying, I was up there analyzing the country and doing some research and also attending a wedding. Translation, he was going to a wedding.
Yeah.
You know, here's a good one right here. I like this one.
I was at Barton Springs under a tree with a towel over my head because I didn't want to be, you know, in the sun, listening to people.
That's a good one. Barton Springs with a towel over my head in the sun.
Welcome back. It's Whoa. The second half of InfoWars Nightly News.
Well, I mean, he is like... doing. I didn't even play that. It just played itself.
He interrupts you. It doesn't.
That's the thing on his show. I have to say, Alex just interrupts everybody. This is a classic right here. Personal all-time favorite. Yes. Intelligent motorcycles.
This is classified, some of this, what you're hearing. A lot of it's been mentioned here or there, the funding. But I've talked to multiple military officers, colonels, generals, you name it, and they turn white when I bring this stuff up. But they have been testing where they have helicopters dump out, you know, 15 motorcycles that are robots. And the motorcycles land. They've got struts on the side that make it pop up to an upward position. It's got guns, weapons, video ports, just like in the last Terminator movie, folks. They've actually got that, okay? I'm trying to explain this to you. Motorcycles that go 200 miles an hour, they had them 20 years ago that were robot remote control. Now they're autonomous. And do you know what they do? They've got your digital photo, folks. And they know what you, and now they're being fed how you walk, all your biometrics. You could be wearing a burqa. They'd know you were John Smith. This is what they're building with just glistening composite eyes of surveillance with the blimps and the drones and the street cameras and the smartphones and millions of Google glasses set to be deployed, where now you're an agent of Google, in their own words, scanning, being fed into these giant AI computers that the humans already aren't designing.
Why didn't we cover this?
Good question.
Yeah, I mean...
hey, stop that!
it's obviously such a big story, and that the U.S. government is using Decepticons to hunt down its own people.
Decepticons? Well, it's not just Decepticons disguised as motorbikes. I mean, your light bulbs are listening too, Matt.
They're launching surveillance system, all the computers, all the software, all the dishwashers, washing machines. Light bulbs are now surveilling through data going over power lines into chips in the light bulbs on record. Mainline articles about the flicker rates to calm you. They're calming the police department with the new light bulb. The Pentagon designed it. Oh, it's liberal. And you're like, wow, I'm reading this in AP out of Minnesota. It's and it also can, the feds can communicate with the police officers' computers now off the flicker rate. I mean, it's just total deployment, body snatcher level.
Body snatchers in the desert.
Movie.
Yeah.
Undercover liberal light bulbs that are surveilling you.
Yeah. I mean, I have to say, he's very entertaining to listen to, but when you compare his early career and the kind of reporting that Alex was doing versus, I think, really... an ideology that many say is just deeply racist and far right, I don't consider it that at all. I consider it a person who watches an awful lot of science fiction films because he makes myriad references to Star Wars. I mean, he plays
Terminator.
Terminator, yes, but he plays the Imperial March as his comeback music. You know,
yeah.
Again, Alex, I think, is somebody who, and we have to be very careful because, you know, we get into that a little bit when we talk about... you know, various sci-fi references, Doctor Who, you know, the Descent by Jeff Long.
Prometheus.
We enjoy films, and we like to incorporate those things in a fun way into the discussions that we have on this show. But you got to be careful when you start looking at what you see in films and begin interpreting that as being the reality of the world in which we exist. Although I would say, you know, the real world, the everyday, is often stranger than fiction. And yeah, there is plenty that you see in films that there probably is a real-world counterpart for, and I certainly don't undermine the idea that there is surveillance beyond what we know to exist. So he's probably right on that. I just don't know about Decepticons. More in a minute when we come back here on The Graylian Report. I'm Micah Hanks. This is the Graylian Report. Monkey Warhol right there. Hey, you kids, don't believe in aliens and UFOs. Ain't no such thing as an alien, right? Well, actually, Matt, you know, the folks at Phys.org are now warming up to the idea, and here is why. They actually note something that we have reported already on the Graylian Report in weeks past, and that has to do with whether or not the 40-year-old Viking mission may have actually discovered life on Mars the first go-round. This is really interesting. It was reported, gosh, last month, maybe even before that, but now Phys.org is picking up on this. I wanted to make sure it wasn't an old article. No, this is dated October 21st. Let's see if there are any updates. They noted, of course, in 1976, two Viking landers became the first U.S. spacecraft from Earth to touch down on Mars. They took the first high-resolution images of the planet, surveyed the planet's geographical features, and analyzed the geological composition of the atmosphere and surface. Perhaps most intriguingly, they also performed experiments that searched for signs of microbial life. Now, in the 40 years since these experiments, scientists have been unable to reconcile the conflicting results that they obtained at that time, and the general consensus is that the Viking landers found no conclusive evidence of life on Mars. But a small minority of scientists argue that the Viking results may have been positive for life on Mars. Now, Gilbert Levin, okay, is one of the proponents of this idea. He's an experimenter of the Viking LR experiment, and at first Levin thought that the LR results were unclear and stated merely that the results were consistent with biology. However, in 1997, after many years of further experiments here on Earth, along with new discoveries on Mars, and these, of course, which NASA has now declared to be a habitable region. Okay, they're on Mars. The discovery of microorganisms living under conditions on Earth as severe as those on Mars, Levin, okay, changed his tune and says basically his Viking co-experimenter, Dr. Patricia A. Stratt, have argued that Mars results from the 40-year-old experiments are best explained by living organisms. Now, listen to that and how they say that. What they have observed is best explained by living organisms. We don't have overt proof, but we have circumstances and we have data that is best explained. Anomalies, if you will, that is best explained by the presence of life. And we have further observed, not on Mars, but in the 40 years intervening, circumstances on Earth that are remarkably similar to the kind of toils that any kind of life, microbial or otherwise, would undergo on the red planet. And so it's looking like there is at least some precedent for the idea that there may have been, you know, biological life found on Mars 40 years ago. What if it ends up being the case that we had found it and we've been in the dark for four decades?
Well, and the thing that the article mentions is that the tests on the Martian soil tested positive for metabolism, which right. would be a sign on Earth that life exists. But they also found... No trace of organic materials suggesting the absence of life. Mm-hmm. So the question we have to ask ourselves, and I think this is a more pertinent or more prevalent ideology that we have now than we did back then, is that we can no longer look at these kind of extraterrestrial, I don't mean that in a sense of aliens, but
Well, I guess you do, really.
Well, I mean, as far as just being outside of Earth, can we apply the same physical and genetic characteristics here on Earth to life on other planets? You obviously can't.
Yeah, see, again, it's interesting that we're learning more about what conditions might foster life on a planet like Mars by studying life here on Earth.
Yeah.
Again, these two planets are pretty similar, but then we look at, you know, locations like Europa, and we think about the idea of a methane ocean in which could life or something lifelike exist. We look at, you know, previous NASA studies that suggest that, you know, lifelike structures may actually come spontaneously into existence out there in the vacuum of space, plasma-esque life forms. You know, the Phys.org article references toward the end Levin and Stratt, and what the two scientists working on this, what they say is one of the most important reasons, in their opinion, for considering the existence of life on Mars, and it has to do with... Well, basically, you know, practical ideas that may affect future research. And they say, and I quote here, "It seems prudent that the scientific community maintain biology as a viable explanation of the LR experimental results." This, written in a recent paper, "It seems inevitable, however, that astronauts will eventually explore Mars, and in the interest of their health and safety, biology should be held in the forefront of possible explanations for the LR results." Now, that's an interesting question because, you know, I'll tell you this, Matt, when we travel around, I think we'll be safe in Charleston later this week. And by the way, we need to talk about that in a moment. So make a note so I don't forget. But yeah, we're gonna write it down. The Charleston meetup. We have a date, a time, and a place. We're gonna talk about that. But when we do travel, and specifically when we go to a country like Mexico, or we go to parts of Europe, or you go to Egypt, when your body is introduced to microbial life forms in the water and the food, and your digestive system, your body in general, is not used to the presence of those in the things that you consume, you can become violently ill. You will acclimate after a few days. And once your body has built up an immunity, you will never, you will no longer, be affected by that, and you won't get sick again. But we think about the way that microbial agents on Earth in different parts of the world affect life here on Earth that evolved and has thrived for thousands and thousands of years, essentially in the form that we are today, right here on Earth. We can get sick from traveling from one side of this planet to the other and encountering the microbial life present in the things we consume when we go there. Again, it is in the best interest of the safety of the astronauts to consider what would happen if we travel to another planet and encounter microbial life forms there. I mean, it's maybe not quite on par with the kind of things we see in sci-fi films, but it's a serious consideration that, our astronauts could get violently ill. And what happens when you don't have any kind of chemical or medicinal aids for a microbial agent that could otherwise attack and possibly destroy a Martian mission? I mean, what happens when all your astronauts are up there trying to colonize and they get sick? It's a very realistic possibility, if not a realistic expectation at this point, but it's certainly something that could happen.
Absolutely. I mean, you have a precedence here on Earth for that, obviously, that you just mentioned. You also have the precedence for a parasitic microbiology, which could be incredibly detrimental to a host and not even show signs for some time after infection. So
yeah, that's a good point. I mean, we just don't know what to expect. And I mean, again, I think that we almost have to go into the whole thing with Mars as though we expect that we already know life is there, rather than saying, well, there's no sign, so really probably no realistic threat or concern, because we haven't had people on Mars yet. Once we get up there, we may have to learn the hard way.
But in the event that we even do go up there in a manner that we deem as prepared by our standards, there's still so much unknown. So I mean, really, all you can only prepare to a certain point, and then you kind of got to be gung-ho about it and just go for it.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, that is what innovation, that is what exploration is all about. To go where no man has gone before, right? That final frontier. Although, again, many would say that the final frontier isn't really space. We're already sending our probes. I mean, so if not space, what would be the final frontier? The frontier of the mind? The great ever after?
Yeah, well, or under our feet in our oceans, things like that.
Yeah, so. Yeah. Actually, I would say as far as Earth goes, the final frontier on our planet is the deep oceans.
Yeah.
So much we don't know, so much potential for, again, strange biology out there in the Earth's oceans. But when it comes to the idea of strange biology, and maybe, yes, that which comes from somewhere out there, while we're talking about aliens, I do want to talk about something. I meant to get to this on the show last week, and we didn't, somehow we missed it. And I've got an update. Actually, let's get to the update first, and then we'll talk about this story. Because, we did talk about Tom DeLonge last week and how Tom DeLonge came up in John Podesta's emails. Just a quick update about that. Apparently, he's broken his silence. PaperMag.com reported on this, and they said that, quote, in the last big WikiLeaks email dump, we learned that Blink-182 frontman Tom DeLonge had emailed Clinton campaign manager John Podesta about a mysterious, sensitive topic. Discussing a documentary he interviewed Podesta for in October of 2015. He followed up with another email to Podesta in January about the Roswell crash site, as well as a lead on the former Air Force official that handled the alleged Roswell remains. We're not sure if Podesta responded or what his sensitive topic is, or whether or not this is an quote-unquote X-file, or whether you remember the time he spilled the cup of apple juice in the hall, and instead of answers, we just have more questions. Okay, so Paper's kind of going down the rabbit hole there, but in essence, we already gave some analysis about this last week. So on last week's show, for those of you who are up to speed with the podcast, you will have heard Tom DeLonge, us discussing what we think was going on, how Major General William Neil McCaslin fits into this, who is essentially named, and the likelihood that indeed, based on a confirmation of receipt, email that was sent by his wife that it probably suggests that there was a meeting that took place at least between McCaslin, maybe his wife was there too, Tom DeLong, who said, I'm bringing him to meet you all. I need his 2 hours of your time. And of course, yes, Clinton campaign chair right now, John Podesta. He's the head of her campaign. He's, you know, chief coordinator, but he's got a long history of involvement in the UFO subject. He wrote the foreword for Leslie Kane's book on this subject, going all the way back to the time when he served in the former Clinton administration under Bill Clinton. He was interested in UFOs then. He has tweeted publicly about how he regrets not obtaining or perhaps pursuing with greater gusto UFO disclosure at various points while, again, serving in government under the Obama administration. So all these things taken into consideration, we know John Podesta to be a person who's been long or has held a long interest in UFOs, and it's pretty obvious why Tom DeLong was targeting him. I'm not so sure that all these media agencies are necessarily up to speed on that or understand the implications here, which is why we reported on it. So our working hypothesis here is that based on these WikiLeaks emails, there was a meeting. John Podesta was involved. Tom DeLong was involved. In likelihood, Major William Neil McCaslin of Wright-Patterson Air Force Base, a high-ranking science and intelligence officer in the U.S. Air Force, he was there, and this is the individual that Tom DeLong, in his book Secret Machines, refers to as the scientist, and furthermore, also the individual who he says helped put together, DeLong saying this, who helped put together his advisory committee. Now, Tom DeLong took to Instagram within the last day or so, and he had put up an image, and what he said with this Instagram post was that, quote, WikiLeaks messed some important stuff up, but he says the project is still on. Believe it or not, things just got bigger. Hashtag secret machines. But interesting that he said that WikiLeaks messed some important stuff up. I can only imagine that what he's talking about there when he said that WikiLeaks messed some stuff up was they revealed one of his sources. But then again, I mean, I have to say, and we touched on this last week, if I were Tom DeLong, I would never have gone into this assuming that these emails were not going to be something that would be read, something that wouldn't be accessible. I mean, with all of the hacks and all of the leaks, maybe Podesta wouldn't have been the likeliest individual to have had his emails hacked. But then again, I mean, with Russia and with WikiLeaks and Julian Assange's interest in the Clinton campaign, or rather, we might say rather than an interest, it's fair to say a disdain for the Clinton campaign, I'm not surprised in the least. I just didn't think that there would be significant UFO data that would come out as a result of this. So this is maybe the most significant UFO-related story that has come about as a result of WikiLeaks and their releases of information to date. I mean, would you agree?
Overall, I would, yeah. I think that's a pretty fair assessment of what's been going on.
Yeah.
You know, and for Podesta to really sit there and think that he would be above this kind of scrutiny in this campaign is just... Honestly, it's
it might border on being naive, maybe,
or negligent.
Although, you know, I like Podesta for the most part. I actually respect his work, both in government and also generally with his interest and his advocacy of serious treatment of the more credible instances of UAP. So, I mean, I appreciate that about him. Now, coming back to the story that I wanted to talk about that we didn't get to last week. This is strange indeed. There was a report, this occurred on Wednesday, October 12th, of an unidentified flying object that was spotted over Geneva, Switzerland, near the Geneva Stadium. And RT, the Russian news outlet, reported that numerous witnesses captured footage of the aircraft. Unfortunately, there haven't been numerous videos that have appeared online. There have been a couple. One of them was pretty weird. I have to say, it looked like a photo manipulation to me, but there were numerous videos that seemed to show three points of light visible in the sky. Now, our primary source of information on this was a football player who was present there, Matthias Vikievies. And he was there at the time that the object appeared, and he posted about the incident on Facebook. And what he wrote, translated into English, was essentially this: everyone sees the same thing as me. It's completely crazy. UFO above the industrial area behind the stage at La Prale. Now, there were photos that were posted by the footballer, along with one video which appears to show the object blinking out or sort of flying away at a high rate of speed after seemingly hovering in place. And I got to tell you, that particular video to me looked kind of like it was faked. There was additional footage that was taken from a moving vehicle momentarily, which, Matt, you were just referencing.
Yeah.
Yeah, it showed the illuminated object off in the distance. You barely see anything in that video, which is a good UFO video. Shows very little. and for not very long.
Yeah.
Those are unfortunately the most credible ones. Now, you know, again, RT reported on this saying that there were numerous witnesses. I've found very little evidence of that, but there was a series of videos that were linked to Vic Kievia's page, which depict a satirical segment on a television program where the interviewer is sitting there interviewing a couple of guys in these goofy little, $5 alien Halloween masks. And one commenter, Archaeo Fox, had written on that post saying that the segment was, quote, irresponsible, pathetic, and disrespectful to the real witnesses, which is interesting because it reminded me, do you remember what happened during the Phoenix Lights incident, Matt?
Not specifically.
Well, Governor Fife Symington in Arizona at that time held a press conference, and he brought out a guy dressed as an alien in handcuffs. And they made light of the entire thing, and it really upset a lot of people because they said, you know, this really kind of disenfranchised the legitimate witnesses who had actually been there, had actually seen something. And years later, Fife Symington comes out once he's able, and he says, you know, I've got to be honest, I've got to come clean. I saw the object myself. It was a large triangular object. It had a distinct leading edge. And whatever this thing was, it was not a conventional aircraft, but I saw it. And basically, we didn't want to incite panic, so, you know, we had to kind of make light of it. And so they bring the alien out on stage and do that whole thing. Well, that's what they did in response to this situation in Geneva last week. I don't doubt that people saw something. It had been suggested that some had seen a drone with LEDs on it. Some had said that it was just a watchtower that's no longer in use, and hence it's not illuminated. And that theory was debunked fairly quickly. But it's an interesting case because the website, which is apparently in the French language, 20 Minutes, they had quoted a couple of witnesses, one fellow named George. Here's what he described. He said it was about 20:30 military time. The phenomenon lasted about 20 seconds, and the object departed at once as if it was burning. George further said that the UFO was, quote, as big as a plane with both static light ends as small projectors. It made a shrill noise. He said, I assure you, I do not drink and I do not do drugs. Now, assertions that the object had merely been a lighted tower, again, were debunked. According to the officials at the Geneva airport, there were no calls that were received on the night in question, which seemed to indicate anything unusual was going on. But there was a statement that was given to the aforementioned news source, 20 Minutes, and they had said that, quote, no drone flight was planned at this place, to our knowledge. This was according to a spokesperson there at the airport. Area law enforcement also chimed in. They said no drone flights or helicopter had been announced or previously registered by the police. So we don't really know what this thing was that was seen, but it doesn't seem impossible to me that there was an actual object that was observed. The few videos and photos that have emerged really seem to show, they said it was disc or saucer shaped, but what we see is three points of light, which again, that may kind of change, or that may be a misrepresentation based on the angle in which we're seeing. This is the problem. David Marler's talked about this, and a lot of other UFO researchers these days will note, a photo doesn't say much. They say a picture can say 1,000 words. Well, yeah, that's the case, but when it comes to UFOs, that's not the case. In fact, a picture says very little, especially when they're so ambiguous, and this one, unfortunately, is once again one of those. And so we're kind of left in a situation where we have a lot that's left to the imagination and no clear answers. But, you know, I am concerned about when we have numerous people saying that they've seen something, how better to play it off as just, you know, mere nonsense than to do a televised segment where we make fun of it and we interview aliens. And so I hadn't seen anyone else make that. I did write about it at Mysterious Universe, and I talked about this. I said it's interesting to me that no one has made that comparison, but there's an obvious similarity to what happened with the Phoenix Lights thing years ago. Fife Symington saying that he saw this thing. I have personal friends. Chris O'Brien, who's been on the show, who we featured on Graylian X this week. Chris O'Brien was present at the time of the Phoenix Lights, didn't actually see them, however. But one of our Graylian newsies, you know who you are, we had dinner, and he told me, you know, my wife and I were standing outside and saw the things pass directly overhead. And he said the eeriest thing about it to me was, if the three points of light were representative of a single large object, we were wondering, and we still wonder, how did this thing get through the airspace at Sky Harbor? How did Sky Harbor Airport not see this thing? So the question is it something that our radar systems can't detect? Or is it something that the radar operators are aware of and willfully ignore? Either way, it's big enough that plenty of other people see these things. So what exactly are these objects in our skies? More on that and other news when we return. It is the Graylian Report.
Hi, this is Jimmy Church of Fade to Black. You're listening to Micah Hanks and the Graylian Report.
Exopolitics. It's beyond the fringe, where conspiracy theory can become conspiracy fact. This is the Graylian Report with your host, Mike Evans.
Keeping you company every Monday night from 6 to 8 p.m. East Coast time, worldwide, around the globe, on the internet via KGRARadio.com. Matt Oakley and I broadcasting remotely tonight. Hey, keep in mind, we are going to be in Charleston this week. It's going to be Thursday night, Charleston, South Carolina. More information about that here in just a moment. Because if you are in that area and would like to attend a Graylian meetup, we'll give you further details. We'd love to see a few of you guys out there. In the meantime, if you are not in the immediate area, there's a simpler way to reach us. You know, they say all roads lead to Rome. Well, all tunnels lead further down into deeper caverns, which eventually make their way down here to the bunker, and you can do so as well. Join us in that great tradition of the Evil Dead. Sam Raimi, you know what I'm talking about. That's right. Join Graylian X. It's just $7 a month or $77 a year. Just head over to graylianreport.com/X. You can sign up today and get additional shows, monthly specials like Enigmas, great commentary from the Graylian gang, lots of good stuff. Past episodes, new interviews, and insight that's got, again, like Jason Pentrell says, and I love this, so I always bring it up, a Sunday brunch kind of a feel. Very different kind of structure for the show, which is intentional. We want it to be something that's a little different than what you get with your weekly show. It would be kind of boring if you just got another show exactly like what we do on a weekly basis, right?
Hey, our shows are never boring.
They aren't. I have to say, people have really sent along a lot of comments and frankly, a lot of praise since you've become a more regular feature of the program again yourself, Mr. Oakley. So thank you for that.
Hey, thank you to everybody out there, because that makes me happier than I can express.
Yeah, I mean, and you do a fine job, sir. So thank you, and thank you all of you out there who support what we do. You can follow us online at Graylian Report is our primary handle on Twitter, but you can follow me at Micah Hanks. Matt's got a Twitter handle as well.
Yes, it's at Graylian Reverend.
Yeah, and that is Graylien for the Graylian. Okay, report just like it sounds. Finally, if you would like to send along a listener email, which we're going to get to a couple of those here in a moment, you can send that to info@graylianreport.com or info@micahhanks.com. I put both of those emails out because they both come to the same place, but the Graylian email is so inundated with news tips from fine people like you these days that I prefer, I think, the correspondence is at the Micah Hanks email, just because that one requires a little less filtering these days. You know, Whitley Strieber once told me, he says, email me, let's line something up, but it's actually useless to send anything. And at the time, of course, his late wife, Ann, was still with us. And he said, email her because it's useless to email me. My inbox is just blowing up and overflowing every day. And I always thought, oh, wow, that must be a high-class problem. Well, a few years after the fact, and now I think I understand what he was talking about. Okay, Charleston, we are going to be holding a meet and greet while I'm down there. The funny thing is Jason and I have been planning this research outing for quite a while, but our final night there in town is going to be Thursday, and we just figured we would do a Graylian meetup if anybody is in the area and would like to come out there in North Charleston. The location that Jason has picked out for us is the Madrua Rua Irish Pub in North Charleston. That's MADRUARUA, Madrua Rua Irish Pub in North Charleston. We're going to be there at about 6:30 p.m. Matt Oakley is going to be making a drive down just to be able to be at this public Graylian function. How cool is that?
That is. I want to hear this kind of shower of praise on me in person, not just via email. So I want everybody to get out there. I think it'll be fun.
Yeah. Well, since last week's show, we've gotten a few queries from people about this. And so indeed, this is the location and the time. We hope that this information is going to get out. We'll be tweeting this out. And those those who have contacted me personally, you know, this information will be passed along to you too. But I know that there are a few people, Will and Paul down there. You know, our good friends Mark and Rebel Jones are there in the area too. And Rebel reached out to me. So they are tour guides with Black Cat Tours. Hopefully they will have one night that they are free that they can join us, if not at the actual meet and greet. But I really would love to see them at the meet and greet too. So, and we're going to be doing some more of this kind of thing in the months to come, because, you know, I was just talking to my good buddy up in New York, MJ, today. Won't make the announcement just yet, but she had some really exciting news, and I'm sure it is going to probably be something that will lead to further adventures of the Doctor in Space and Time to the Big Apple. And love that city. Got to get back up there. So, Matt, you're going to have to come along. You know, Daniel Bishop, one of my wonderful traveling companions, she also has threatened to come with me because she's a musician. She said, you know, take me with you when you do one of those events, when you, you know, go up there, book some shows, and when you're doing your music stuff, you and I can do a duo. And I thought, you know, for the singer-songwriter kind of thing, that would be great, because she's a violinist and she would be perfect for that. So we're hoping to have a lot of really cool stuff coming up in the next few months, really, that you'll hear more about here on the show. Just more ways that we can reach out to you and bring you into the fold, the Graylian family. Speaking of the Graylian family, by the way, here are a few notes from guys like you out there in the listening audience. Aaron writes, Micah, I was recently listening to the Graylian Report from October 10th, actually, the story about Elizabeth Hawk, and it struck me as odd. He said, not only have I been interested in mysterious cases of disappearances like the David Pilatus research, but I also live near the area where Elizabeth went missing. So we've got some ground reporting from one of our listeners here, Matt.
That's awesome.
He said, I decided to go and check out the building that was associated with the story. Now, the store is a warehouse-style building with high ceilings, and from what I could tell, is essentially one giant room. Even the loading dock section was not blocked off from the store. And so observation number one is that, quote, there are no ladders or means of getting onto the roof from the inside of the building, he said. I then went around the building to see if I was missing anything, and observation number two is that there is a large height difference between the adjoined buildings, PetSmart, and the Home Depot. So being on the roof of one store wouldn't necessarily mean you could easily get to the roof of the other. The only way that I can see someone getting up there is if there were maintenance people on the roof and they left one of their taller ladders propped on the back of the building. He said, I understand that this presents more questions and no answers to the mystery, but I thought it was interesting nonetheless, and I haven't seen any news on this case, and it's been over a month now. So anyway, I love your podcasts. Thanks, Aaron. And Aaron, thank you.
Yeah, though I don't know how much more that clarifies things. It may just make the story even stranger than it was before.
Maybe so, but still, it's you know, good to get updates from our listeners.
Oh, absolutely, yeah.
I do appreciate that, Aaron. Jimmy writes, Mike, I just started listening a few months ago, and I have to say I'm a big fan of the Graylian Report. Hey, incidentally, Matt and I are too. He says, from the content to the delivery to the evidence, I'm just a huge fan of your approach to this topic. Now, I've always been a believer, but a skeptical one, who has a very tough time with the leaps and the claims some UFO researchers and experiencers make. I have a long commute to work, so I listen to a few different podcasts, one being called Spaced Out Radio with Dave Scott. And I enjoy his show from an entertainment standpoint, and I think he does a great job at what he delivers, but I've had a hard time swallowing what some of his guests are selling. Now, one in particular, R. Keith Andrews, is a monthly guest on his show, and I'm sure you are familiar with his claims. Actually, I'm not. I've never heard of him, tell you the truth, but he says, I've heard him make claims including helping a race of reptiles rescue ships from a black hole.
I'm sold.
You are? Yeah. I knew. Yeah, they had you from reptile.
Yeah.
The fact that humans were built by fairy folk, claims that there is a planet Mobius immediately opposite of Earth in orbit. He claims he has walked through walls. He claims to have contact with dozens of different races. He claims to have been given a mission at birth by a council of 12 to help the human race. The list goes on, but in all cases, he openly says he either has no proof, was told not to share proof, or simply says something is too hard to understand. And in all these cases, he speaks in absolutes and in some cases an almost haughty tone. I can't recall any question where he didn't pipe up with an answer like he, quote, absolutely, unquote, had. My question to you, Jimmy writes, is what do you think about folks like this? Are they delirious and are they seeking attention? Are they attempting to exploit those looking for information and answers? Or is it possible I'm actually missing the boat and he really does have all these experiences that sound strangely close to fiction works? Keep up the good work. And if you get this, thanks in advance, Jimmy. Well, Jimmy, thank you for writing. Okay, my take on this, it really just comes down to this. I don't think that necessarily everyone who makes, you know, really bizarre claims is a liar. I really don't. I think that there are a range of different ways that people interpret things, but I do think that some people are just out and out liars. I do think that some people are just trying to get attention. I think that some people maybe begin kind of bending the truth a little bit, but as time goes on, they begin to kind of buy their own hype. And although I've always taken a skeptical kind of a bent, I remember when I was in my early 20s and I was attending a meeting with a local paranormal group, and I'd suggested, I said, I would like to be the skeptic in the group. I said this, I said, I am someone who's open to considering crazy claims, but I really think that we need to, you know, employ some good skepticism here. The skepticism that I attempted to try and bring to the table with that group ultimately led to me leaving that group. Now, see, the modern skeptics would probably consider me, Matt, and this is, I mean, I'm sure this is maybe unwarranted in that worldview, the mind that no, it isn't, no, it can't, no, it doesn't, you're wrong, that modern skeptic atheists would espouse. They would see me as a harmful pseudoscientist or a purveyor of pseudoscience, if not a pseudoscientist myself. But, and in many ways, I could probably construct an argument that the modern skeptical thinker, the big S skeptic, as we might call them, would call me more harmful than the kinds of people that Jimmy wrote and asks about. Because, you know, when someone's just so crazy that everything that they sound or sound off saying and everything that they bring to the table is purely fiction and obviously so, that can be taken with a grain of salt. Whereas someone like me, you know, who has an air of credibility and who's always promoting skepticism, but nonetheless is willing to address strange subjects, that's actually more deceptive and hence more dangerous. And hence, maybe I'm the real danger. And I think it's fair to ask that question, because I asked that question myself. If by trying to be skeptical, but being willing to address subjects that seem to at least have some merit to them, but that fall outside the reaches of what we call science, if by presenting the kind of dialogue that we do on the Graylian Report in the way that we do, if by doing that and seeming to have a sense of credibility in our approach, are we actually more dangerous in the sense that we are more likely to compel people to consider non-scientific claims? I would, of course, say no, but here's the reason why. Because I think that the modern academic institutions are at times too heavy-handed with what they perceive as being pseudoscience, or with what they perceive as purely anecdotal claims with no foundation in reality, because there isn't something physical that can be measured. And I was having this conversation with Tiffany Mack recently, where I was talking about, again, conceptual truths. Science, and this is what we have to remember, science seeks to study things that can be measured, that can be ascertained and studied in experimental circumstances, which primarily deal with physical quantities. Now, we have, you know, fields of science like archaeology and history, which don't necessarily deal with physical observations. Science can be done with those things which cannot be directly observed. We cannot directly, Matt, observe the construction and the ceremonial rituals or whatever other circumstances may have played out in the ancient past at a site like Göbekli Tepe or at Stonehenge, for that matter. We can't observe. And although science relies on observation, it would be silly to say that, well, because we can't observe those sites, that archaeology isn't really science. Of course it is, but there has to be science applied to those things which can't be directly observed. And so I would say that taking another step, to the right or left, whichever direction you want to call it, from the idea of science and good science being applied to those things which cannot directly be observed, we should be able to say that there may be things which fall outside the normal range of observational data, but which nonetheless may represent physical constructs or realities in the reality that we observe, and that it may be wrong of us to say that those things cannot and therefore do not exist. I think a more appropriate scientific stance to take it would be that, well, our current observational data does not yield results, but we won't rule out further study based on the expectation that our scientific understanding and the technological applications that we may have at our disposal in the future may allow better study at a later time.
And I agree with you 100%. And I think too much of today's society, and at the very least, scientifically minded, straight-laced people, really have narrowed the vision field of their any given study, I think. And so they say that anything outside that narrow thought form is inherently pseudoscience, without merit, etc. But all science had to start somewhere outside of the norm. So,
well, you know, again, our attempt to try and understand those things which we do not understand, our attempt to explain those things which we cannot explain, that is essentially what, you know, compels us to engage in good science. And yes, there is a lot of pseudoscientific quackery. And frankly, I wouldn't even call people who are just going out there telling stories, I wouldn't call that pseudoscience. It's so far removed from science that it couldn't even be called that. Again, I think good pseudoscience is something that at least it seeks to explain a set of observations, or it seeks to, you know, offer a perspective on things that may have some basis in science. But the problem is that they don't, like good science does, seek to explain a broad range of things in a way that takes into consideration all points, all evidence, all data, and at times conflicting opinions and data. Pseudoscience tends to be something that cherry picks a single thing that is interesting and often takes it out of context. A great example, you know, when I was down there in the Yucatan, we see various representations in ancient Mayan art of, you know, Mayan leaders, having passed on into the afterlife and descending into the underworld. And famously, in Eric von Daniken's book, Chariots of the Gods, and subsequent books, he would make the case that these actually depicted ancient people behind the helm of a spaceship. And I think that we have to be very careful when we look at ancient art from cultures that, of course, had no concept of, as far as we know, of space travel. And we filter that through our modern not just expectations, but, you know, our knowledge base that does account for things like space travel and the technological society in which we exist. Now, on a recent episode of Graylian X, though, we had also spent some time looking at the idea that there could be life, or rather there could have been maybe advanced civilizations that existed long enough ago that we don't have a full picture or even really any kind of substantive data that accounts for their existence, but that this might explain certain out-of-place artifacts and things that show up from time to time. And we have to be careful, because I think that when I have said advanced civilization, people think that I mean advanced like we are today. You know, again, Tiffany Mack and I were talking just last night about the Cretan colonies that were, that existed there on Santorini Island prior to the famous eruption that occurred there. The Cretan colonies were in decline leading up to that explosion, which is an interesting thing unto itself. But prior to that decline, they were some of the most advanced anywhere in the world, these colonies. They had indoor plumbing. You know, they had running water. They even had hot and cold water. I mean, their sewage and their plumbing at that time was far greater and far more advanced and far more efficient than anything else in the world. But that wasn't necessarily on par with the kinds of things that we see in the world today. You know, at the ancient sites in modern-day Pakistan, Mohenjo-Daro and Harappa, they also had sewage systems and drainage that, again, based on archaeological excavations today, seem to indicate more advanced drainage systems, irrigation systems, and sewage systems than what we see in certain parts of the Eastern world today. But that doesn't necessarily mean that on the whole that those societies were more advanced or equal in terms of their technological advancement to people here on Earth today. Because I think that we have to recognize technology is typically cumulative. In those days, the evidence doesn't seem to suggest architecturally, in terms of written language or otherwise, that these cultures had significant interaction with each other. There was some interaction. And again, some of the alternative history theories that I find most compelling are the interactions between people in different parts of the ancient world. But we have to be very clear. And again, you know, I think that when you read and you study and you educate yourself on these kinds of things, your perspectives will change over time. Back in the old days, you know, years ago, I probably was far more open to what I would consider less scientific ideas, and I'm okay with at least considering ideas that might not fall lock and step with modern scientific theories or consensus opinion on, you know, things. But nonetheless, I still will say I can consider those things without saying, yeah, and I think therefore that reptiles, you know, once ruled the planet, but they were humanoids and not, you know, dinosaurs, and they went underground, and that they're still the aliens that are controlling us, our overlords. You know, I don't have to say that that's what I believe. And I don't believe that, by the way, but I will,
you sure?
I will, if there is a reasonable theory, I will at least give consideration to it. But again, I would maintain that if anything is something that eventually will be worthy of deeper consideration beyond just pure speculation, it has to be something that can withstand serious scrutiny by science, and it has to be. But I also see certain subjects that I think would meet that criteria that modern academicians often turn their nose up at and say, we will have nothing to do with that. We got to find some common ground. And, you know, it's very interesting, you know, when you look at the fine line between good science and pseudoscience. You know, it's a contentious situation, and I think it'll continue to be. But yeah, so, you know, in defense, maybe, Jimmy, coming back to your email, of people who just go out there and say crazy things, I think that there are some people who are so hardened in their skepticism that they would consider me. You come to me asking what I think about the crazies. There are people who would certainly tell you they think I'm crazy. This is why I defend what I do, because I try to bring a scientific approach to understanding the mysteries of our world. And yes, I disagree with the modern, often espoused academic notion that people's innate need for mystery is what fuels belief in the unexplained, and that there is no such thing as mystery, that we've already solved all the great mysteries. I don't believe that. I think that there's plenty yet to be discovered and plenty yet to be studied, and hopefully at some point maybe understood. But we've got to be open-minded enough to get to the point where we can ask those questions rather than just turning up our nose and saying, no, it can't, it doesn't, it didn't, it won't. No. Dominic writes, so Westworld, it feels tailored to our community. The rise of organic AI, the implications of man acting upon his or her primal and sometimes very dark impulses and desires, the moral quandary of what happens when they finally become aware, want freedom, perhaps restitution for past digressions, not to mention the subtle undertone that speaks to me of this simulated universe that man has created for his own devices. Who's to say our own isn't? So I adore this show, and it's right in our wheelhouse. I would love to hear your thoughts on the show. Would you find the time to partake? And appreciate you all, and all, as always, look forward to the next show. Thanks for writing about that, Dominique. I got to say, I have not watched Westworld yet, but our friend Cortana and I were talking the other night, and Cortana being a Fader Knot, part of the Fader family, and also, of course, a Graylian listener going back quite some time. And she was saying, Micah, have you watched Westworld? And if you haven't, you need to change that. Make that happen. Well, I will, Dominique and Cortana. And a happy shout out to both you guys and anyone else out there right now who we have neglected so wrongly at this moment. But we're happy to hear from all you guys, by the way. info@graylianreport.com, info@micahanks.com. And on the heels of this discussion about archaeology, Matt, you know, when we come back in the next segment, I want to talk about the latest observation of our monkey kindred. And what they've been observed doing that has a lot of anthropologists going, what? Yeah, this is pretty interesting. I mean, it may not really rewrite our history, but it's certainly an interesting observation. We're going to talk about that and much more when we return here on the Graylian Report.
You're listening to The Graylian Report with Micah Hanks. He'll be back after this message.
The dark heart of the Appalachian Mountains. I'm Micah Hanks, and this is the Graylian Report. I want to get into this 100 monkey theory here in just a second, and really what it has to do with what modern anthropologists have recently observed monkeys doing. But before we get into that, and I'm not just trying to go down the road of monkey business, but Matt, our weekly creepy clown update, because I know that you have particularly moved that we talk about creepy clowns every week. I'm just kidding.
Yeah. I've moved on from us. I was talking about it every week.
I think you're tired of hearing about them. I can't blame you. So am I. Although I think I owe the creepy clowns a debt of gratitude, because I've begun having a remarkably deep, insightful, and frankly, just very wonderful dialogue with one of our listeners that stemmed from a creepy clown email. And so maybe I owe these clown-faced marauders a debt of gratitude. But yeah, the latest creepy clown scare has apparently been occurring in Germany. Police are now saying that there have been 5 incidents involving so-called scary clowns that have occurred in 2 North German towns, including one assailant who hit a man with a baseball bat amid fears that Halloween could spark a rash of similar attacks. Do you remember there was a one of the graphic novels of from the Batman universe, DC Comics, that was called The Long Halloween? Do you remember that, Matt?
I don't remember that one.
I don't think it...
I think I vaguely recall that one.
Yeah, and it was a Joker story. Yeah. But, I mean, the thing is what's interesting to me is, I mean, all these clown incidents are occurring leading up to Halloween, and I almost kind of wonder, I mean... I don't know. We've talked an awful lot about it, so maybe I won't run down that road. I wanted to get this creepy clown report from Germany into the mix, though, because it's the latest of numerous locations where these continue to be reported. Every day I keep waking up thinking it's all going to be done with. Will we ever get past the creepy clown scare? Who knows? But I will say this. There is a story that has been making the rounds. It's said that an infinite number of monkeys sitting in an infinite number of typewriters would eventually produce the works of Shakespeare. You ever heard that, Matt?
Say that again?
That an infinite number of monkeys sitting in an infinite number of typewriters would eventually be capable of producing the works of William Shakespeare.
I have heard that before.
Okay, yeah. Well, this is interesting. Yahoo News reports that new research finds that a non-infinite number of monkeys holding a non-infinite number of rocks might at least produce something like stone tools. Now, what we saw were little capuchin monkeys banging rocks against one another, and they are creating flakes, okay? They're making stones once thought to bear the telltale marks of tool-making in human ancestors. Now, what we're seeing here is not monkeys creating tools, but what we are seeing is monkeys banging rocks in order to probably expose mineral content on the interior that they can lick so that they can get, you know, minerals. They're breaking these rocks, and they're creating perfect little flakes of stone, which we once thought, okay, archaeologically, were something that only ancient humans could have made. And so we've gone to these ancient sites, and we found these stone flakes, and we're like, yes, this is evidence of human flint knocking and the like. Well, monkeys do this too. So have what we found in the past and thought to be evidence of early humans, have these merely been locations where monkeys were trying to get minerals? That's the question, okay? Now, this monkey behavior suggests that archaeologists need to be cautious, according to an article that appeared in the journal Nature on October 19th. They need to be cautious about assuming that humankind's ancestors actually made real stone tools. They say that the production of archaeologically identifiable stone flakes and cores, as currently defined, is no longer unique to human lineage. The stones in question are simple, little, flat, shallow, shell-shaped breakages called conchoidal fractures, which, of course, show the signs of repeated chipping. An earlier study showed that chimpanzees and bonobos don't make choppers like this. Again, something that, if held correctly, could function as a stone knife. But this study, I mean, it's really interesting because, I mean, really in concluding, they say within the last decade, studies have shown that the use and intentional production of sharp-edged flakes are not necessarily linked to early humans, who are our direct relatives, but instead were used and produced by a wider range of hominins. I think we also have to ask, though, if hominins, like, for instance, the capuchin monkeys that are observed doing this today, could have done this. Could our ancient early ancestors have been banging stones together for similar reasons in order to obtain minerals? I guess, again, it doesn't mean that we can rule out all instances of these stone flakings as being evidence of ancient humans and the creation of tools. We can't rule out that humans were involved, but again, it may not have been the intention that this was done to create something that had a functional purpose. But, you know, when we go down to Charleston next week, I'm hoping to spend a little time looking at and speaking with some experts who have spent some time at one of the oldest Clovis-era settlements, which is located in Allendale County, South Carolina. This is known as the Topper Site. And what's interesting about the Topper Site is, I've mentioned it before in the past on the show, the Topper Site is believed by some experts to be as old as 20,000 years, whereas most of the rudiments of the Clovis culture, and you can't deny the kinds of stone tools that they were utilizing, because when you look at what we find at places like the Topper Site and throughout parts of South Carolina, all parts of the ancient Americas, the Clovis stone tools, the arrowheads that they created, for instance, again, 11,000 years old, but obviously intentionally designed. And Matt, I was showing you a picture of one from one of my books over here earlier. And it's very obviously evidence of a fairly sophisticated design, which gave them an incredible advantage in the ancient world, not maybe in terms of warfare, but certainly in terms of being able to command their environment, to be able to ward off predators, and more importantly, to be able to obtain food. I've heard these spear points that were utilized by the ancient Clovis culture as being referenced in the past as being a technological revolution, the beginning of a technological revolution 11,000 years ago in North America, which is a crazy concept. And frankly, I love the idea that, you know, this is evidence of ancient technology that we see. So, I mean, when we're talking about advanced technology, I mean, a stone knife or spear point may not be what many would hope for when we talk about ancient technology, but it is ancient technology, and it represents nonetheless a turning point in our evolutionary history. Okay, so we've spent an awful lot of time tonight, Matt, already talking about archaeology and about science versus pseudoscience. We've delved a little into alien life and how maybe Vikinglander data suggests that we did find alien life. We've looked at UFOs and the other side of things. We've kind of run the gamut tonight, but there's one thing that we have not yet talked about, and in the spirit of the season, it would be really terrible, horrible, horrifying if we didn't. And you know what that is? You do know what that is, don't you?
Is it horror?
Yes, it is our own fascination with those undying things of the undead variety.
What's that sound?
It is horror music! You may be wondering, Matt, why we're playing horror music here. Actually, you're probably not, because we've talked about this. We've talked about what we plan to do right now. I want to get into just a little bit of discussion about some of our favorite horror films. Yeah. Because it is that time of the year. The sun begins to sink a little sooner, and the shadows begin to grow a little longer. We hear frightening stories, or we remember ones which we had hoped to forget. Dare I say, we don't think of those things before we go to sleep at night. Or else, of course, we have those kind of dreams. And let me remind you, nightmares are dreams too. Happy Halloween, everybody. You know, one of the most eerie subjects, and I wrote about this for Jim Herold's website recently, Matt. One of my favorite eerie subjects is the Ouija board. The only time in my life I've ever experimented with one of those damned things was with you at the Reynolds Mansion. Yeah. Do you remember that experience?
I do. I remember that you and I were the only ones who would initially mess with the thing, you know.
Everybody was too scared to touch the Ouija board. Now, the story goes that the Ouija board had been sent to us by one of our listeners. He mailed it to Ben and Aaron at Mysterious Universe, and they signed it, and then he mailed it to us, and he was mailing it around to different podcasters and having his favorite podcasters sign this Ouija board. And I said, I'll do you one better. We'll use the Ouija board in an actual psychic experiment at Reynolds Mansion, which in my book, Reynolds Mansion, A Invitation to the Past, Matt and Chris Hayes and I and Marty Marfia, Lisa Northrup was there. We all went to the Reynolds Mansion and we did this experiment one night. It was sort of a seance, but there was also a psychometry experiment and some different things, some strange stuff that did happen that night. I got to be honest, it was right around this time of the year. In fact, it was a night just like tonight. Tonight is the anniversary of the night. Worst accident.
Worst accident I ever saw.
No, I think it was, Matt, I think it was worst accident I ever seen. Yeah, but so everybody was too freaked out by the presence of the Ouija board. And so here's Matt and I by our lonesome doing this. And it was funny because we asked if there was a presence there in the room. And do you remember what happened when the planship began to move? Do you remember what happened?
I don't recall right off the top of my head. It's been some time.
Really seemed to have had a real lasting effect on you, didn't it?
I remember the night as a whole. Probably the portion that actually had the biggest effect on me is when we were sitting there doing the book experiment.
That was the psychometry thing, yeah. Vance Pollock had suggested that we do that, where we would each open a book and we pointed to a line. And it was funny because each person's line seemed to have a remarkable relevance to, again, and you might try this if you're ever at a party with a group of friends and you want to try a unique experiment. This is what we did to conclude our experiment there at the Reynolds Mansion that night. We each took an old book and we opened to a random page and pointed without looking, and then we read the sentence that we'd pointed to. And it's almost kind of like the fortune cookie phenomena where it's...
Yeah, that's what I was getting ready to say.
Yeah, it's either incredibly, remarkably relevant to you and your life and what you're doing right now, or it has nothing to do with it, and it's hilarious and really worth your time. Anyway, just because it's fun. So, I mean, I would recommend that you guys at home try this. info@graylianreport.com, info@micahhanks.com, tweet at me @MicahHanks. If you try the psychometry book experiment, we'd like to hear what happens for you. It'd just be interesting to hear. And it's a little fun kind of a thing to do here on Halloween. So there at the Reynolds Mansion, we did our Ouija board experiment. And since you don't recall, I'll tell you, Matt, what happened when we asked, was there a presence here in this house? The planchet began to move very slowly, and it went down to the letter I. And it hovered and stayed at I.
I do recall that. Yeah.
Yeah, and it didn't do anything else. And it was funny because we kind of thought, well, that's weird. Why I? Why I? Well, I've amassed a lot of weird stories of Ouija boards over the years. And I got to tell you, I think maybe one of the best ones that I recall ever hearing was a conversation live on the radio that I participated in a number of years ago. I'd been asked to come in and help with an interview with a musician that came to visit the radio station where I worked at the time. And the musician was Ellis Paul. He's a really, really well-known songwriter out of the Boston area. His songs have been featured in different films over the years. And so Ellis was coming through town, and they said, you know, Micah, since you're a singer and a songwriter too, it would be helpful for you to be able to be in here and help interview him. So Joshua Warren was the gentleman who was actually sitting in as the host that night, and he and I came in to interview Ellis Paul. But despite my interest in talking about music, one of the questions that came up had to do with Ouija boards. I have to admit, I'm equally interested in that subject too, and Ellis told one of the strangest stories about a Ouija board that I recall ever hearing. Here's a little of that story for us right now.
Well, I was out for a run with a buddy of mine in Boston, and it was a long time ago, and he said, why don't you come over for dinner? And I said, sure. And we sat and we had a glass of eggnog there. It was around Christmas time, and went over to his place, and his girlfriend was working on the dinner in the kitchen. And I said, what have you been up to? And she said, well, I just bought this Ouija board for $1 at a garage sale. And she said she's kind of been addicted to it, talking to some spirit with a friend of hers, Beth. And she's been on it like people get on the internet, you know, and just going haywire there. And I said, well, you know, I'm kind of a doubter a bit on that end of things. So I said, why don't we take it out as part of the dinner party and take it for a spin, see what happens. So there were about 15 of us there, and we went into the living room, and I was the person asking questions of the ghost, and the ghost was named Pug. Margaret Putnam was her real name, but her nickname was Pug, and that's sort of the handle that she used when communicating through the Ouija board. And I asked Pug, with Margaret and Beth on either side of the board there handling a little triangle, I said, what song did I play last night at my show? And it spelled out R-A-I-N. And sure enough, I had played a song called Let It Rain. And but, you know, if you're going to choose a title of a song, rain might be in a good percentage of them. So I didn't think too much of it. And I said, well, what's the name of my booking agent? And I knew that neither woman at the Ouija board knew it. And it's spelled out G-E-R-M-A-N-E, Germain. But it misspelled it by one letter. So, I don't think there's a spell check in a Ouija board. But so I kind of let that one go. And then I said, what did Vance and I, my buddy, have to drink before we came to the dinner party? And it's spelled out N-O-G. And I got up and I locked myself in the bathroom for a while and freaked out, and ended up writing a song about it based on someone who had passed away and using a Ouija board to communicate.
Wow. Right there at the end, Matt, you heard my 24 or 5-year-old wow. But during the commercial break that followed in that interview segment, Ellis elaborated further to me off the microphone. He said, you know, there's a bit more to that story. Margaret Putnam, the name that came through on the Ouija board, he said, I was compelled enough by that experience that, you know, there in Boston, I went down to the library and I began to dig around. And he said that I found not only that there had been a Margaret Putnam, but as she said in her correspondence with my buddy's wife, she had been married to a doctor and that she had died under the exact same circumstances that had been related to Vance's wife. So, I mean, he said it really kind of confirmed to me that there's more to this Ouija board phenomena than most think. I found it a very strange circumstance. Again, hearing this story, randomly being told by one of the, arguably one of the most talented singer-songwriters in America, sitting right next to him in the studio. I was closer to him in that studio than you and I are across from the console here, yeah, from one another. But, you know, my it's not my fear so much of Ouija boards as it is, I think people around me, Manly Hall had been quoted talking about Ouija boards back in the 1940s. And it said that, you know, again, a Ouija board is something that he says, of all the people I've ever talked with who have used these things, you know, very few have ever come out the better for it. My mom, back in the 1960s, with her neighbor Nancy, had been playing around with one. She didn't know what it was. Nancy says, oh, come on, it'll be fun. And they start messing around, and a guy named Ralph begins telling the story of how he had flipped his Chevy convertible as he drove off the side of a bridge and was pinned underneath it in a river, and he drowned before they could get there to save him. There's the story that my friend Chris back in high school and his girlfriend at the time, Jessica, talked about, in which she wanted to play with a Ouija board one night, and he thought, oh, you know, whatever. Okay, sure, yeah. So he humors her. Rather than going out to the movies, they play with the Ouija board. And he says that they began having a dialogue that this nebulous kind of series of answers starts coming out, and then gradually the intelligence, if you want to call it that, on the other side begins to explain that it's a little girl who had died of consumption in the Western United States back in the, you know, sometime in the 1860s or 70s. And she says, my desire is to be born again because I didn't get to live long enough when I was a child. And then she says, if you have a baby, may I be born into your child? Well, they were a little creeped out by this. You know, here's this young couple and they're, you know, being asked if through a Ouija board, if a ghost can come into the child's body and be born again. And Chris said at that point, he said, he asked her, well, where are you now? And he says the planchet moves very slowly over to the letter H. It hovers there for a moment and it goes over to the letter E. And then it moves slowly over to the letter L. And it just stays on L. So he asks, why are you in hell if you were a little girl? He says the planchet moves up to I. And it hovers for a moment on I. And then it moves down to K, I, L, and it rests on L. I kill. And he, at that point, asks, okay, so the little girl is in hell because she kills. He says, what are you? And it starts to spell out, and it moves up slowly, D, E, M, O. And he said, we took the planchet, we moved up to goodbye, and we have never touched a Ouija board ever again.
You know, it's funny. I hear so many of these stories having talked to you over the years. And then I remember right before we went out to Reynolds Mansion, I was talking to my mom on the phone, and I said, she was like, well, what are you going to do? And I started explaining some of the experiment ideas to her and everything. And, you know, mom, we're going hard these days. It's, you know, we've always got to one up ourselves. So I brought up the Ouija board thing, and she goes, oh, I had one of those when I was 12. That was a lot of fun. And then she just hung up the phone. So,
well, you know, again, when the Ouija board was first created, it was designed as a parlor game.
Yeah.
And it was, you know, the two creators actually handed the operation over to their employee, William Fuld, who went on to try and say that he actually was the creator and that they'd stolen the idea from him. And Fuld was known for bringing lawsuits against people who made, similar things, because at the time, I guess he did actually own a copyright or a trademark for the Ouija board. But of course, it's owned by Parker Brothers now. And since the 1960s, Parker Brothers have owned the trademark, and they have been the sole legitimate producers of what is known as the Ouija board. Ouija, rather than being some esoteric term, is just a combination of we, the French, and then ya. The German for yes. So it's the yes, yes board is basically what that means. But
I like how they don't have no in there.
Right. Yeah. But, you know, another funny Ouija board story for you really quickly before we talk about some other horror themed things is we're going to be doing over the next couple of weeks here in the mood of the season. We do this every year on Graylian Report. We try to focus on some good horror kind of stuff, but, Halloween themed stuff. The story that always amused me the most was I got an email from a young man in Australia who had obtained one of these vintage Ouija boards. And he said, I got this Ouija board. My mother gave it to me to try and help me cope with my sadness around the time that my grandfather died. Now, his fundamental question when he wrote to me was, he said, you know, Micah, I just wondered if you thought it was safe to use Ouija boards. And he said, when I was using this Ouija board, he said, at one point, my grandfather or something or someone claiming to be my grandfather came through the Ouija board and actually communicated with me. And I said, well, that's rather novel. What did he say? And Artemis was the young man's name. He said his grandfather told him, don't play with Ouija boards.
That's awesome.
Yeah. I mean, I could go on, though. I've heard so many unusual stories about Ouija boards over the years. And there's an entire segment in my book, Magic, Mysticism, and the Molecule, that really talks about those. But, you know, make of it what you will. You know, these are some of the best stories I've known. And are there any horror movies, Matt, that involve the use of Ouija boards? I can think of one.
Good God. A lot. You have The Exorcist, you have Ouija that came out 2 years ago, then you have Ouija that just came out this weekend. I mean, the list goes on
and
on.
We should do a parody of Ouija, and we should call it Squeegee.
Squeegee. I love it. We got to get back on doing these parody trailers and such. They were so much fun.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Yeah. We've had a lot of fun over the years. There's some videos. If anyone out there is a real internet archaeologist and you dig deeply enough, you can find some examples.
A Graylian historian.
yes. We've had a few Graylian archivists. You know, Tyler Pittman is the official archivist of the Graylian Report. He's the guy who chronicles our exploits behind the scenes. So, but there may be others out there that I don't even know about. Okay, yeah, I knew that in The Exorcist, that the idea had been that I think that little Reagan had been playing with a Ouija board, and this is what brought Pazuzu.
Captain Howdy,
as he went by. Yeah, it's like, you know, Pazuzu is so last season. Let's come up with a much more menacing nickname. Captain Howdy. Howdy ho!
That movie still terrifies me, man.
My father being a priest, you know, the office next to the church was my office back in the old days. I would go over there, and I authored all of my earliest articles that I ever published in Mysteries Magazine, Fate Magazine, you know, all the different magazines and stuff that I'd been writing for Nexus. And no, I didn't publish in Nexus, but New Dawn I did. And I would write a lot of those old articles, you know, in that, and actually certain fiction stories that I sent along to different magazines too. Back in the day, I mean, I wrote everything in that office. And so how fitting, I thought, in this little chamber of lore next to my father's parish, that I would not only write articles about weird things, but I would watch The Exorcist for the first time. And so I sat alone in a dark room next to a church watching The Exorcist. Didn't scare me at all.
See, it still bothers me, but I tell you, if you ever get a chance, have you read the book? William Peter Blatty's book? Oh, that is a phenomenal work of literature, if you ask me. The book didn't get to me at all. The movie really, maybe it's because I watched it initially so young, but the movie did get to me and still does. But the book, I'd highly recommend anybody out there willing to pick it up. It is a great character story or study of the priest. And man, that book is good.
And a lot of my friends in theological circles over the years have said the same thing. And in particular, with relation to those films, that the third film was perhaps one of the best in terms of its representation.
Special effects, the third one, absolutely brings it home, if you ask me.
Yeah, I mean, it was a different kind of a film. And actually, one of the scariest scenes in all of cinema history is attributed to that film. There's a scene where they're in the psychiatric ward. There is you see nurses walking along, and a nurse walks down the hall, and it's very quiet, and she crosses across the hall, and then immediately behind her, you see this entity carrying a knife walking behind her, and it is considered one of the scariest scenes in cinema history. You can find that.
It's a good one.
You can find that on YouTube, but I'll tell you what else is...
I'm partial. The one that I was referencing just a minute ago, I thought I knew what you were going to say, but the one that always pops into my mind from 3 is where he's standing there in the psychiatric ward, and you can see her up on the ceiling, crawling across the ceiling.
No. Do you remember the scene I'm talking about?
Yeah, there, absolutely.
With the bandaged character with the knife? Yeah, that is a creepy scene.
Oh, yeah.
But I think one of the altogether creepiest films of all time, I have to say, it hands down would have to be a film that was directed by Werner Herzog. It was called Nosferatu, Phantom der Nacht. That was the German title.
Yeah.
And here you're hearing a bit of the theme music, which I loved because it was very atypical for a horror film. What this movie was it was a remake of the classic film Nosferatu, okay? which was the story behind that was that at the time they didn't have the rights to be able to play off of the Dracula name, so they had to come up with a different name. And so F.W. Murnau, the German director, decided he would do a film in which it was the story of Dracula, but with different names. Instead of Dracula, it was Count Orlok. I think it was actually Orloff.
Orloff, I think, was the original.
I think you're correct, actually. Okay. Thank you, yeah. So Count Orloff, and again, instead of the name of the story, Dracula, it was Nosferatu. Well, Werner Herzog decided in 1979... to do a remake of this film with Klaus Kinski, the actor, who, although he's made up in the visage of the Nosferatu, the bald vampire with rather than the canine teeth that are sharpest, it's his two front teeth that are the sharpest, mirroring the appearance of actor Max Schreck from the original Nosferatu from the 1920s, the silent film. But there are so many things about Phantom der Nacht that I found so unique and... You know, I probably shouldn't say this, but Matt, you know, the entire, I've seen recently that Nosferatu, the vampire with a Y, it has recently been uploaded on YouTube. You know, from time to time, the film shows up. The reason I say I shouldn't say that is because there are a lot of movies you can watch for free online. This is one that, you know, if you've got an independent film DVD rental place in your town, go and ask and see if they've got it. You know, it's something that's worth watching, but I support the arts. And I know what it's like to be a musician and know that, you know, somebody is, you know, downloading my stuff for free, or somebody has hacked Graylian X or something and is downloading, which actually that's never happened. There was somebody who accidentally uploaded some files of Graylian X freely available. Nobody even knew about it when they weren't downloading them. The guy didn't realize he had accidentally put his content up for free, and I contacted him when we fixed that. So, but it was scary, and the reason I had to contact him is I realized, you know, hey, as an artist, you want your... And that includes being a podcaster. You know, you want the integrity of what you produce and the artistic merit to be recognized and met. Every artist goes through this. This is one of the most artistic and yet also one of the most frightening films.
Well, you have Herzog, who's such a great director, too.
Very much so.
Yeah, you his filmography includes greats, if anybody wants to check him out, like Rescue Dawn with Christian Bale. You've got... Bad Lieutenant with Nicolas Cage. And then on Netflix right now, they have Grizzly Man, the 2005 documentary that won big at the Oscars that year. So he's a pretty stellar director and knows what he's doing.
To say the least, he's long had an interest in strange things. And again, the cinematography in this film, this film is just almost unprecedented in the imagery that it shows. And the actor Klaus Kinski, who portrays the vampire, I mean, it's he is someone who needs very little in the way of makeup, I'll say that. But this film is just a different take on the entire story of the vampire, one of the eeriest, both in terms of the music that is featured, Kinski's portrayal of the vampire, which is innately a very lonely individual, you know, someone who has an unspeakably and frightening, though also undeniably sexual nature. Mm. But, it, you know, that's juxtaposed against this outsider, this, you know, this individual, this lost boy, to borrow from another, you know, horror film from the 80s. So, you know, again, that's a favorite, and it's a rather atypical one, I think, you know, that is very worthy of a second look. But, you know, Matt, I can't help but think when we're talking about horror movies, in that same vein, the vampire films and programs that featured similar content, Dark Shadows was a favorite of mine.
Oh, absolutely.
You know,
and we talk about Reynolds Mansion, the Dark Shadows imagery they've got out there is quite prevalent.
Well, absolutely, yeah. And I intentionally featured a lot of that into my book that I wrote about that. But, you know, one of the actresses who's featured in the original series, which ran between 1966 and 1971, we had the actress Joan Bennett, who played Elizabeth Collins' daughter, the old mother there at Collinwood. And if you've never watched the show Dark Shadows, you know, for a while, there were a series of episodes starting with, you know, maybe roughly episode 350 or so, when Jonathan Frid, the Canadian actor's character, Barnabas Collins, the vampire, appeared. They started right around the time that he showed up on the show, and that was on Netflix for the longest time. But if you go back to the beginning of the show, it really just began as a... as a, you know, kind of a noir-esque kind of a thriller story, very little in the way of overt supernatural themes. There was the hint of the idea of ghosts, but it was a gothic, a modern gothic show, which again, gothic literature is really, rather than the macabre elements, it is really kind of notable for the irony that's present, the irony and certain other themes. And Dark Shadows began as a show like that. But, you know, Joan's character probably was one of my very favorites in terms of her, you know, the way that Joan Bennett portrayed Elizabeth Collins Stoddard. The reason I mention her now, though, Matt, is because her character, okay, on Dark Shadows was memorable, but it wasn't the only memorable role that she played. And in fact, I think her last film role was maybe her one, the one that Joan Bennett is best known for. Do you know what that was?
Oh, there's the music.
Well, that gives it away, I'm sure.
Yeah, yeah. It's Suspiria, one of my all-time favorite films.
Her final film, Joan Bennett's final film was, that's right, Suspiria.
Suspiria.
The soundtrack provided by the artist known as Goblin.
Yeah, we should grab the audio from the trailer. You remember the one of the greatest taglines that's ever existed for any movie ever is at the end of the movie trailer.
I don't know if I remember that overtly, but
it was the what was it?
Oh, I know exactly what you're talking about, actually. It just came to mind. Okay, yeah. Yeah. Right, okay. I got to make sure. I think this is the right trailer.
Roses are red, violets are blue, but the iris is the flower that will mean the end of it.
You can run from Suspiria. Than the last 12 minutes of Suspiria.
Or the first 82 minutes of Suspiria.
Man, I want to watch that film again. Okay, so we've already stated at the outset of the show, we're not in the bunker tonight. We are in, I don't want to give away too much information. I mean, we don't want to lose the mystique, but we are in a very old home in North Asheville. And we can see out the windows. The sun is setting. It's already getting dark. We've got most of the drapes pulled and there are only candles lit.
Yeah, yeah. That's all the light we have here.
I planned this so that when we got to this part of the show and the creepy stuff started happening, that the ambiance would be set here in the studio.
And it absolutely is. And I'm already excited from talking about one of my favorite movies of all time, Suspiria. If anybody out there has not seen this and is even remotely a fan of horror movies or thrillers, stop what you're doing. Well, don't stop what you're doing. Listen to us. Then go out to wherever you can rent this movie and watch it.
It's that good. I mean, it's one of my favorites. Jacob Robert, who you'll remember, of course, he was one of the people who turned me on to so many great films, and I watched Suspiria because of him. Mm-hmm. And I think that for me the scariest film that I've ever seen, in truth, was The Descent, which is
I remember it getting to you quite a lot.
The reason it got to me is what's most important about it is, you know, again, and our friend Tiffany, who's been co-hosting with us on some of the Gray Lane X shows, Tiffany asked her husband, hey, look, for my birthday, here's what I want. And he got her a copy of the book, and she just finished it. And she was like me. She read it. She was fascinated. You know, Shannon LeGros is reading it right now, too.
It's a great book.
Yeah.
Absolutely a page turner.
You've read it. Yeah.
Yeah, I couldn't put it down.
See, we built a lot of the Gray Lane mythos around that book, but the film is not based on the book. The film is scary. I enjoyed the film, but I would love to see a film. See, if a film of Jeff Long's book, The Descent, were to be made, it would be like The Descent, the film, meets The Da Vinci Code.
Yeah, it's a lot more sci-fi than horror.
Yeah, the book but is. It's also a bit of one of those kind of theological thrillers. I mean, there's a lot of that kind of. I mean, there are so many different elements that fit into it. But in terms of films kind of like that involve things underground, caves, monstrosity, weirdness. You know, another favorite, man, all-time favorite.
From the director of Altered States and the creator of Dracula comes a new classic thriller with a bite. Ken Russell's The Lair of the White Worm, starring Sammy Davis of Hope and Glory, Katherine Oxenberg from TV's Dynasty, Amanda Donahoe, and Hugh Grant of Maurice. In a remote corner.
Excuse me.
Yeah, I started to say they didn't even mention him, man.
Yeah, are we forgetting anybody here? I mean, anybody at all who might have been like, oh, I don't know, more prevalent through the film than anybody there mentioned except for Hugh Grant? Is there anybody at all?
Did he wear a scarf or anything like
that? He used to wear a scarf a long time ago. Yeah. Oh, I know.
Hello, hello. Rubbish robots from the dawn of time.
Thank you for all the gratuitous information.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, Peter Capaldi, our current Time Lord in chief, the Doctor himself, he was one of the lead characters. And in the final sequence of that film, again, the last minute.
Maybe we should let him know what film we're talking about.
Oh, yeah, it would help, I guess. Yeah. Go ahead, Matt.
Yeah, The Lair of the White Worm.
It's quite hilarious, though, that they don't even mention Peter Capaldi. I mean, this is one of his early shining roles.
Present-day England, a young archaeologist named Angus Flint on Earth.
That is, by the way, Capaldi's character. Oh, they can mention his character. They just, don't name the actor.
It's a mysterious ancient skull and uncovers a horrifying pagan mysticism. When the skull suddenly disappears, strange things start to happen. And Angus begins to suspect the bizarre and serpentine Lady Sylvia Marsh. Together with his friends Mary and Lord James Dampton, Angus sets out to destroy the horrible white worm and his evil worshippers before they make a living sacrifice of the young Virgin Eve.
It's kind of funny, though, because, again, you know, they don't even mention Peter Capaldi in the credits there at the beginning, but it's like all the story of Angus, you know, how he and his friends go. Yeah, great film. The special effects, the scenery, the cave, you know, it was filmed. All of this, it's just a remarkable
And it
film.
Has a real cool psychedelic element to it.
There is a little of that, isn't there? Yeah.
Just like Suspiria does as well with Argento's color creation and things like that. A lot of the makeup and light that Ken Russell, who also is a visionary director, in addition to...
Actually, a director of films dealing with visionary experiences.
Yeah, yeah. Because you know how I feel, and I believe I turned you on to Altered States.
Yes, you did. I'd never seen that.
Which is a great film.
I'd never seen that, yeah. Well, yeah, you know, so many films that we could delve into. I'm trying to think, though, is there one film that stands out among the rest in terms of, you know, horror films?
Would you be able to compose, like, a list of just... horror movies that you go back to, like five essential recommendations that you could give the audience?
Well, yeah, I certainly could. Let's start with this right here.
Do you know what the most frightening thing in the world is? It's fear.
There is nothing to worry about. You're going to be just fine. I'm your number one fan.
She just goes a little mad sometimes. We all go a little mad sometimes.
I like to dissect girls. Did you know I'm utterly insane?
I just can't take no pleasure in killing. Just some things you gotta do. Don't mean you have to like it.
Hello?
Have you checked the children?
Whatever you do, don't fall asleep.
I'm afraid!
Don't be afraid!
No. Be afraid. Be very afraid.
You just can't let them go.
Go. Stay on the road. Keep clear of the moors.
Beware the moonlets.
They mostly come at night. Mostly.
I'm scared to close my eyes. I'm scared to open them. I'm gonna die out of here.
It's alive. Watching. Waiting.
Now clear your minds. It knows what scares you. It has from the very beginning.
I mean, that might be a good start, don't you think?
Yeah, that tackled so many good ones. I'm sitting here as that's going on and just being like, oh, that one.
I know what you mean. I do.
I love them.
We might have to save any further stuff for next week. I don't know. How much time have we got here, Matt?
I think we got a couple minutes.
Okay. So yeah. What do you propose?
I propose we each throw out 5 essential Halloween movies to the listeners.
Okay.
And I want them to get back in touch with us if they can watch.
Yeah, we want your lists too. Your 5 essential Halloween films. But let's go one for one, you and I.
Okay.
Let's do this right though. Let me see. I'm having to delve deeply into the archives to be able to find some good stuff. I think I've got some stuff here. Okay, let's see if this works right here. Okay. This will get us into the mood. Matthew, please give us your first essential creepy Halloween film.
I'm going to go with John Carpenter's The Thing.
Oh, I love that.
Love it.
All-time favorite. Okay. I'm going to go with The Fly, but not the original, the remake with Jeff Goldblum.
So good. I wish I would have gotten that one.
A film that legitimately disturbs me.
Oh, yeah. It's so awesome.
Legitimately disturbs me.
David Cronenberg, great director.
He was, remarkable. And there are a lot of different thematic overtones and undertones about what people interpret the plot in that film to mean.
Yeah. I'll go with an all-time favorite werewolf movie, American Werewolf in London.
That's a good one.
It is.
That's a good one. I'll match you with The Howling.
Oh, classic.
Mm-hmm.
Those are the two best werewolf transformations in film history, if you ask me.
They really are.
Let's see. Next, I'm going to have to go with maybe Throw Out the Hills Have Eyes, the original Wes Craven.
Yeah, it's a scary film.
It is. It's very unsettling.
That one's definitely scary. I'm going to go back to the original Universal Pictures, though. I've talked an awful lot last week with Mr. Sam Sheeran. I told him, and he actually beat me to the punch. We both really identify with Frankenstein's monster. I mean, you talk about an outsider, the misunderstood, monster. I identify with that character. And so the original Boris Karloff rendition, although I'll also give a nod in reference to the Frankenstein character, Universal Pictures, and that classic portrayal by Boris Karloff, great though it was, the portrayal in the recent series Penny Dreadful, in which he is referred to as the character John Clare, that was also really good. But really, almost any representation of Frankenstein's monster, Robert De Niro,
started to say I love De Niro's.
That's De Niro was really good. You know, there was even a stage rendition of De Niro's character, or I'm sorry, not De Niro's character, but Frankenstein's monster, which featured Benedict Cumberbatch in the role of the monster. So, yeah.
And I think I'm going to see a stage play of the modern Prometheus next weekend. So
are you really
excited about that? Yeah.
Oh, I wish I could tag along. Gosh, but... Well, we'll see. We'll see. Yeah. You're up.
Okay. I'm going to go with another Cronenberg movie, The Brood.
I haven't seen that one.
No, it's so good and weird and creepy.
Yeah, it sounds like one I should see. Let's see here. Where are we? Are we 3 or 4?
4, I think.
Okay. My fourth? Well, I would say The Descent. I mentioned it already, but I mean, that's a film that I think is well worth mention here.
Yeah. Let's see. The Big 5. This is tough, man.
Is tough.
I just love horror movies so much. So there's so many I go back and revisit. Okay. Event Horizon.
Oh.
Lawrence Fishburne. Sam
Neill.
Neill.
Yeah.
Yeah. Great film. That movie creeps me out.
I recently revisited that one. Yeah. And it's a very strange film. I guess for my fifth and final, Matt, I would have to probably say Francis Ford Coppola's Dracula. The scariest experience I recall with regard to watching that film wasn't just watching the film, but waking up after falling asleep one night while watching the film and waking up to the scene where the old, with the creepy hairdo, the old Gary Oldman is standing there laughing into the camera, and I wake up from a nightmare where I'm being chased through Dracula's castle, and I see Gary Oldman's Dracula laughing in my face. Boy, I didn't sleep that night. Comparing that film with Werner Herzog's earlier offering in terms of vampire films, it's like night and day, or maybe we would say, given the circumstances, night and night. Good night to all of you out there in the twilight realm of Fortiana. It is the Graylian Report. The Graylian Reverend joins me. I'm happy to have a holy man here in the Hollow Earth as we delve into the deeper and, frankly, the creepier aspects of Halloween horror over the next couple of weeks.
Yeah, me too. Surrounded by the white light.
We must always bathe ourselves in the white light of hope, truth, enlightenment, And cosmic love, my friends out there, to all you guys in Gradioland. Thanks for tuning in as you do. And on behalf of yours truly and the Gradian Reverend, as well as Chris Hayes, Caleb Hanks, Jeremy London, Tyler Pittman, Racing Robin Hobbs, Dick Oakley, John Anderson, I remain the Doctor in the Dark Heart of the Hollow Earth, Micah Hanks, and it is the Gradian Report. Stay strange and a bit creepy out there. And we'll catch up with you again next time as we continue Halloween coverage here of the autumn season.
Been listening to the Gradian Report with Micah Hanks. Any rebroadcast or duplication of this program or program content without express written permission is strictly prohibited. The Gradian Report, in direct cooperation with the internet website, GradianReport.com.